This is has been kind of a quick background overview. We've talked about the Sumerians. We've talked about the pagans living over here, the Greco-Roman culture. Yeah, I should just mention as a follow-up comment, James and I were just having a brief conversation here during the break. You know, Satan uses the exact same things to distract people today. If Satan can't deceive people, he'll certainly distract them because it's just as good. Satan doesn't need to get us totally over to his wavelength, his way of doing things. If he can just distract us from keeping our noses in the Bible and following God, that's good enough because he's accomplishing his purpose. And what does he use to distract us these days? Same four things we've talked about there, the schools, the stadiums, the theaters, the temples, and so on. So what are our biggest distractions in today's culture? Well, sports and entertainment. That's what so many people spend their time on. And ultimately, it's a waste. Doesn't mean totally avoid it because it's nice to have some downtime. But a lot of people go to extremes on that, and that becomes their lives. And they end up wasting their lives on these things that ultimately don't mean a thing, aren't doing anything to help us learn and follow God. So we've talked, now back to the story. We talked about the Sumerians. We talked about the Greeks over here. Let's talk about some other areas. And I've covered some of this already. But let's talk about the area to the north of Galilee, specifically around the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus Christ carries out much of his ministry. And who are these people that he's interacting with too? Again, Jerusalem is a center of religious fervor for the people there. It's where the temple is located. But Galilee is also a center of religious fervor, as we've talked about, the prophecy that we started off with of the Messiah appearing in the lands of Naphtali and Zebulun. And Galilee will see the light of the Messiah. So I talked about this earlier, how a lot of Jews return out of captivity in Babylon, where they had been exiled by the Assyrians, and then specifically the Jews taken to Babylon in exile. A lot of the Jews decide to stay there after the fall of the Babylonian Empire, but the ones who do return to Jerusalem and to Galilee, expecting these prophecies of a Messiah to be fulfilled, are extremely religious, very devoutly religious. This is why there's so many of the Pharisees that Jesus encounters. These are very devoutly religious people there. Actually, I'll skip over this period of Antiochus Epiphanes. Have you talked about that in the book of Daniel? Daniel 11, the kings of the north and south. Haven't gotten to that? Okay. It's not particularly relevant to our story, but Antiochus Epiphanes, one of the successors after Alexander dies, his empire is divided up among four of his generals, out of whom comes Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the Darth Vader of ancient times. He tries to stamp out the practice of Judaism in Israel at that time. And the Jews revolt against this. What he would do specifically, for instance, things... You can read about this in the book of Maccabees, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which is an apocryphal book, but a historical book. And he did things like, for Sabbath keep, he would execute people because he was different from Alexander in that Alexander had a pretty good relationship with the Jews and didn't try to force them into Greek culture. It was more of a voluntary thing with Alexander. With Antiochus Epiphanes, he tries to enforce worship of Zeus and Athena and the other gods and so on, and to stamp out the worship of the true God. So if he catches somebody keeping the Sabbath, he executes them. There are accounts in the books of the Maccabees that if mothers circumcised their baby boys, he would, this is gross, but illustrates his mindset, he would kill the baby boy, hang it around the mother's neck, make her walk around with her dead baby hanging from her neck, and then eventually kill her too. This is the cruelty of this guy, and the Jews revolted against him and this is where the festival of Hanukkah comes from, out of this period of history. So the Jews managed to throw off the Syrians. They're more Greek in culture, but they're located in Syria. So they throw them off and establish an independent Jewish nation under the Maccabees there. So this is in 168 BC, the Jews regain their independence for the first time in more than 400 years, dating back to the destruction under Nebuchadnezzar, the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians. So once a new Jewish independent kingdom is established in Israel, a lot of the Jews who have been living in Babylon now move to Galilee. In expectation, they're familiar with the prophecies that we read at the beginning of today's lecture. Zebulun and Naphtali and a light dawning in Galilee. So they know the Messiah is going to appear there. And again, this is a map we've been looking at the back. So about 40,000 Jews move from Babylon or from Judea into this area of Galilee during this period of basically the first century B.C. They know from prophecy when, the 70 weeks prophecy, when the Messiah is to appear. So they want to be there. They want to be there when the Messiah shows up on the scene. So they move there, and a lot of these cities that we read about, like Capernaum, like Chorazin, like Magdala, like Gennesaret, like Nazareth, these towns didn't exist earlier. A few of them did and were destroyed by the Assyrian invasion, but most of these are new towns that are founded in the first century B.C., and again, they're founded by very devoutly religious Jews who are expecting a Messiah, and they want to be there. We know this from archaeology that most of these towns are founded there during this time period. Most of them are quite small, anywhere from 100, 200 people up to 2,000, 3,000, something like that. They're not large, but they are there. And we also see from the Gospels that the religious establishment in Jerusalem looks down on the Galileans. They view them as a bunch of uneducated country hicks. And you see even things reflected like in Nathaniel's comment, can anything good come out of Nazareth, referring to Jesus' hometown. But that was that too is some of the conflict between Jesus and his disciples and the Jewish religious establishment, because there, that's where the famous rabbis are. That's where they teach and so on. So they look down on this hick rabbi from coming out of Galilee as they would have viewed Jerusalem. Here's a photograph showing this general area of the Sea of Galilee. Here's Capernaum right here, Bethsaida over here. Chorazin is back up on this hillside about 2 miles north of Capernaum. Here's assumed site of the Mount of Beatitudes. Gennesaret is over in here. Magdala is down below us here. Magdala is currently being excavated just in the last couple of years there. You know, the area where Jesus is conducting his ministry. There's a number of little port towns along here that are based on fishing and so on. And incidentally, the Via Maris that we talked about earlier would have run along this plain, this nice level plain, and then turned north up this valley. So this area here is filled with very devoutly religious Jews. So this is another important group that we encounter. We've talked about the pagans, we talked about the Samaritans, now we're talking about the devoutly religious Jews. And this is most of the people that Jesus is interacting with on a regular basis. And you see this in things like him having deep religious discussions with these people. Questions, teacher, what is the greatest commandment? And this kind of thing. These were hot topics of discussion at that day. Not how your fantasy football team is going to do in the playoffs. but things like, teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law? And so on. That is what is on their minds. They're focused on God. They're focused on religious things. As an outgrowth of this, there is another group in this area known as the Zealots. one of Jesus Christ's disciples is a zealot. They're also called Sicarii. You don't need to know that, but Sicarii. The Sicarii means literally dagger men, because these people hated the Romans. Their goal is to see the Romans kicked out and a Jewish kingdom established, the Messiah to establish his kingdom on earth. So they hate the Romans, so they keep they're called dagger men because under their robes, their cloaks, they can hide a dagger in their belt, come across an unsuspecting Roman, or somebody who collaborates with the Romans, like a tax collector, like Matthew. They will pull out the dagger and get behind the guy in a crowd and stab him in the back. And the body falls to the ground and they slip away into the crowd. That is something we know was taking place this time. These were the zealots. They were essentially guerrilla fighters, is what we would call them today. And these, in the gospel, when you find situations where people want to make Jesus a king, this thinking is coming from the zealots, because that's what they wanted. They want a king, a leader, a general who's going to lead them into battle and cast out the Romans and establish the kingdom that was foretold through the prophets years ago. So it's interesting, among Jesus Christ's disciples, you have Matthew, who's a tax collector, and you also have a zealot there who's one who would have killed a tax collector if given the choice. So, well, let's move to John 6 and read. This is where Jesus feeds the thousands of people by multiplying bread and fishes. And this plays into what we read about here. John 6, verse 11. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted. So when they, the crowd, were filled, he said to his disciples, "Gather up the fragments that remain, so that nothing is lost." Therefore they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves, which were left over by those who had eaten. And notice this. Then those men, when they had seen the sign or the miracle that Jesus did, the miracle of multiplying the loaves and the fishes, said, "This is truly the prophet who is to come into the world." Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he does what? He gets out of there. He departs again to the mountain by himself alone. He flees. He runs away and hides, lest they take him by force and make him a king. Okay, let's think about this in light of what we've just read about the zealots. And they're called zealots because they have a zeal for God and establishing a kingdom there. Nothing would have stirred up the zealots more. I mean, if you're a zealot, you want to throw out the Romans. Who is your ideal general, your ideal leader? Well, how about a general who can raise the dead? So you get a soldier who dies in battle, and you've got a general who can walk over and pick the guy up and send him back into battle. If you're trying to feed an army of 10,000 people, what could be better than a general who can multiply a handful of loaves and fishes enough to feed an army? So yeah, you bet they want to make him king. You bet they want to make him their general. And Jesus knows this. And that's why there are times when he, as we just read, slips away, lest this happen. Because what's going to happen if they do make him a king? Well, it's going to be a rebellion against the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is going to come in like a ton of bricks, and it's not going to be pretty. And people are going to die. And the general, the leader of this, is certainly going to die if the Romans catch him. So Jesus is not going to allow that to happen, because that would totally destroy his mission and lead to a premature death on his part. So Jesus has nothing to do that. So we see during his ministry that he is judicious. And when he performs miracles, sometimes he tells people to go and tell people about this miracle. Other times he heals someone and says, "Don't tell anybody about it." Why does he do that? Well, the obvious answer is sometimes when he does a miracle and tells people not to tell anybody, it's because of this underlying mindset of the people, like the zealots there, who if they hear of miracles are going to want Jesus to make him a king and to lead a rebellion against the Romans. And that's going to end up, as does happen, in 67 AD, the rebellion against the Romans breaks out. Incidentally, it breaks out in Galilee and ends up with a total destruction of the Jewish people at that time. They're either killed or sold off into slavery. Ends up with Jerusalem being destroyed, the temple being destroyed. So that's why at times Jesus says, don't tell anybody about this miracle. Because that's obviously happening in one of these areas where there's a lot of zealots there, this area of Galilee near there. Other times, like he heals a demoniac, a person demon-possessed, in the area of the Decapolis, and what does he tell the guy to do? He says, go and tell everybody. Because there's not a threat from the Decapolis of people who wanting to make Jesus the king. They've got a king. It's the Roman Empire. This explains some of the things that aren't spelled out for us in the Gospels, when we understand the background of who is who, where these different groups and cultures are. Incidentally, when Jesus is crucified, there's a term there. Matthew and Mark at least say that he was crucified with two robbers. And the word robbers is actually the word that can and is translated elsewhere as zealots, the people who are the zealots. So apparently these men are zealots who are crucified for trying to rebel against the Romans there, and they're put to death. Now, what accusation did the Jewish leaders make against Jesus? Notice this, Luke 23, 1 and 2. This is at his trial. They're bringing him before Pilate. Then the whole multitude of them arose and led him, Jesus, to Pilate, and they began to accuse him. Now, when he was on trial before the high priest and the Sanhedrin, what did they accuse him of? Blasphemy for making himself the Son of God. When they bring him to Pilate, the Roman governor, they change the charges. And what do they accuse him of? We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king. What's the basic charge? They're charging him with sedition, with treason, with rebellion against Rome, which is an offense for which the penalty is capital punishment in the form of execution. So the Romans aren't going to put up with anybody else claiming to be the king because they've got a king, and it's called the emperor. This is a thread that is there in the background of the Gospels. It's not specifically spelled out. But the Romans couldn't care less who or what Jesus calls himself or so on, whether he blasphemes as the Jewish leaders accuse him of. They don't care. So the Jewish leaders, the religious establishment, when they bring Jesus to the Romans, they accuse him of sedition and rebellion so he can be put to death. And this threat of rebellion was very serious to the Romans. And of course, that did lead to the destruction of Jerusalem. There was actually a little literal battle that took place on the Temple Mount, as described by Josephus. Here's a depiction of that, the altar and the temple. And this is how the temple was destroyed. You see the Roman soldiers battling against the Jews who have taken shelter there. Again, this isn't explicitly spelled out, but it's a continual thread there in the background of the Gospels. So there's this group, too. Now let's move on and talk about another subculture of people who live around the Sea of Galilee. In that region of that day, what is the biggest city in that region? It's Tiberias, named after the Roman Emperor Tiberius. Tiberias, as near as we can tell, was a city of possibly as large as 50 to 60,000 people. Capernaum, in comparison, is probably around 2,000, so it's a much, much bigger city. It's not that far, maybe 6 to 8 miles as the crow flies from Capernaum. And yet we never see mention of Jesus setting foot in Tiberias. Why would that be? Well, just something to think about. We'll answer that in a few minutes. So who is living around Tiberias? Who are these people? You got the pagans over here. You got the religious Jews here. You got the zealots kind of mixed in right around here. In the Jewish war that started in 67, two of the hotbeds of rebellion from the zealots were this town of Gamla over here, as well as Magdala right here. So this area is the hotbed of zealotry that leads to the destruction of the nation several decades later. There's another group of people mentioned in the Gospels called Herodians. Herodians, like Herod with an I-A-N-S on the end of it. These are people who are Jewish, but they are secular Jews. Religion doesn't mean anything to them. They are generally wealthy. They are pro-Roman. They're called Herodians because they are the hangers-on, the allies of Herod the Great and his sons, his descendants, his offspring. They are the supporters, and Herod, of course, was allied with the Romans. He was ruling under their authority and was supported by the Romans. So these are people who are allied with the Romans. They're secular. They're not religious Jews. The only three times the Herodians are mentioned in the Gospels, they are plotting to discredit or kill Jesus. So they also saw him as a threat to their power, to their prestige, their position. They have adopted a lot of the Roman culture. And we see this in the city of Tiberias. Tiberias, some of it has been excavated today. You can go there today and see remains of this wall, for instance, part of the port. Most of it is underneath the modern city of Tiberias. If you go to visit the Sea of Galilee today, you'll probably stay in a hotel in this area on top of the old city. They had a modern main street like this one, just like the Roman cities were. They had a large theater that is currently being excavated there, just like the Romans. We talked about the theaters before. They even had hot springs and hot baths, public baths there, which you can walk around the ruins of that there at Tiberias today. There's another factor at work, and this is, in my opinion, why Jesus never visits there. Talked about an individual yesterday, Herod Antipas. Did what? Who did he throw in jail and later execute? John the Baptizer. This is one of Herod the Great's sons who is ruling over this area. Where does he live? He lives in Tiberias. So I think this is probably why Jesus never visits Tiberias, because this is headquarters. That's where he has his palace. This is an artist's conception of Herod Antipas. This is a coin showing him. No other depictions that I'm aware of him. So he's there in Tiberias. So even though it's only about 8 miles away as the crow flies, Jesus never visits there that we know of. Probably because had he done so, Herod may well have captured him and perhaps had him imprisoned or jailed. So why doesn't Herod, knowing that Jesus is just 8 miles away as a crow flies in Capernaum, why doesn't Herod go over there and do something about Jesus? Well, this is where an interesting factor of geography plays into the picture. There's this large mountain called Mount Arbel. Capernaum is right over here. Tiberias is out of the picture over here on the right, about over where the doorway is. And this mountain in that time ran right to the edge of the sea. There wasn't a direct road from Tiberias to Capernaum. There was a road from Capernaum over to Magdala and so on, but it couldn't get past this mountain because it just runs right into the sea. So the only way to get by road from Tiberias to Capernaum was to go about 30 miles out of the way. So if Herod Antipas were to send some people to try to capture Jesus, he's got some advance warning to see this military detachment coming over there. So this, I think putting some of these factors together, this is probably why Jesus is never imprisoned or captured here. For those of you who are students of history, I mentioned this yesterday, I think, the Battle of Hattin, where the Crusader period ended in Israel, where they were defeated by the Muslims under Saladin. How many of you have seen the movie Kingdom of Heaven? Okay, just a few of you. If you want some good entertainment sometime, watch the movie Kingdom of Heaven. This battle is depicted quite realistically there, as well as the battle for Jerusalem when they defeat the Crusaders, move down to Jerusalem and capture that after a siege. It's a brutal look at warfare at that time, but a very realistic look at it too. And the Muslims defeated the Crusaders and drove them out. And this battle took place right there at Mount Arbel between Tiberias and Capernaum today. So Darris McNeely and I went up and visited and walked around on part of that battlefield several years ago. So, yeah, continuing, talking about the Herodians there around Tiberias. But again, back in Jesus' day, in Galilee, as near as we can tell, most of the Galileans that Jesus encounters are people who are very serious about their religion. That's why we see Jesus going to the synagogues in all these little towns. Every little town and village has its synagogue there. And we know this from archaeology as well. They've excavated a number of them there. And they're very serious about their religion. They are very, very dedicated to trying to obey God and live according to Scripture. And these are the people Jesus is interacting with at the synagogues and teaching and asking questions of Jesus and asking him for healing. And the crowds of people who are following Jesus as he travels around, they are devoutly religious. So this explains some of the different reactions Jesus has among different people that he interacts with. Again, the heart and core of this area is this little triangle up here, Capernaum, Bethsaida, and Chorazin, roughly 3 by 5 miles. And this is where about 70% of Jesus' teaching that we read about in the Gospels takes place in this little tiny area, about 3 by 5 miles. Many of the miracles that we read about take place right here in these three cities. We tend to think that Jesus' ministry covered hundreds of miles as he's traveling around. No, it didn't. Took place in a very small area. But again, as we talked about yesterday, word of that gets out because of the Via Maris, this road that runs right through the heart of this area as well. There are a few times when he does go further afield, goes up to Caesarea Philippi, which is further up this Via Maris, as we've talked about. There's one case where he travels about 40 or 50 miles over to the coast of Lebanon, for instance, and he goes to Jerusalem regularly for the holy days. But that's about as far as he ever traveled, is from what we see recorded in the Gospels. Now, I want to give you a quick summary to wrap this up and pay close attention. Write this on your map, the map on page 139 at the back of your Harmony. We have Jesus settling here in Capernaum. So who are the people that he interacts with? We've talked about the ones to the east and southeast, the pagans. These are the people with the pigs who run down into the sea where the parable of the prodigal son is set there. So this eastern side of the Sea of Galilee is Greco-Roman pagan culture. Those are the people who live there. Most Jews, self-respecting Jews, would not set foot there lest they be defiled by contact with this paganism. Who are the people directly north of this and kind of on the border with the religious Jews and overlapping? This is primarily the Zealot country. I might call them Jewish nationalists. They were patriots. They wanted to make Judah great again here. These are the people who want to kick out the Romans, the ones who would kill a Roman or a collaborator with the Romans if given a chance, the dagger men. Moving further around the Sea of Galilee, down here around Tiberias, are the Herodians. And there's very little contact Jesus has with these people, the Herodians. Again, these are the family and the supporters of Herod the Great and his sons, administrators, the rulership, the local rulership. By the way, I should mention here too, we tend to think of this being ruled by the Romans, and that's true, but they kind of subbed out the administration to local rulers. Judea is ruled directly by a Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. But the rest of the areas, again, you see these delineated in shades of gray on your map, they're ruled by the sons of Herod the Great. Except for Judea, it started off being ruled by one of the sons of Herod the Great, Archelaus, but he was such a horrible ruler, the Romans replaced him and put a Roman governor there. So the Herodians are the people who are allied with them and supporting that system. It is Roman, but it's not Romans themselves who are administering that. It's Jew, the descendants of Herod the Great, who is half Jewish. So those are the Herodians. They like their Roman lifestyle. They like their theaters. They like their games. They like their entertainment. Moving a little further afield, we have talked about the Samaritans at considerable length down here, down to the south, the very bottom of your map there. The Samaritans down here, the people who the Jews and the Samaritans hate each other. They just as soon kill you as look at you. There they believe only in the Samaritan Pentateuch, the five books of Moses. So there's a lot of conflict between them and the Jews. And then finally, the last group that we've talked about here, the religious Jews up here in Galilee, the ones who have founded these towns that Jesus does much of his ministry in. These are people who are devoutly religious, who are expecting a Messiah. Again, they know the Messiah is to appear in the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, and they want to be there when the Messiah comes. And these are very sincere, very devout people. Some are misguided, like with their Sabbath rules that we talked about earlier, but Jesus feels quite at home with them. That's where he spends much of his time. He's grown up in Nazareth, a town founded by these very devoutly religious Jews. So it is helpful when you read through the Gospels to look at this map, see where Jesus is and what kind of people he's interacting with and what their religious background is, what their cultural background is, what their history is. And it helps us understand where these people are coming from and why some of the things take place that we do. And a lot of misconceptions can be cleared up when we simply understand which group of people it is Jesus is interacting with. So I actually finished up this part 5 minutes early. So any questions about any of that? I've given you a ton of stuff to think about and digest. No questions? Yes, Danielle. Yeah.
I had a question, and actually I think it was from one of the earlier classes from last semester. But you made a comment that during this time period they wouldn't allow new religions. So that would mean that Christ's, you know, that the Christian religion really wasn't different. And I think that was, and I was just hoping you could expound on that or where maybe that information comes from.
Sure. Great question. And very relevant, particularly relevant. You guys are just getting into the book of Acts, and Mr. McNeely will probably talk about this a bit. But yeah, the Romans talked very early on about the Pax Romana, P-A-X Romana, the peace of Rome. The Romans valued required stability in their empire. The Roman Empire encompasses hundreds of cultures and ethnic groups. And to unify the empire, they were kind of a lot like Alexander. Alexander, as we talked about, wanted to unify the people with Greek culture and thinking. The Romans wanted to do the same thing, just a slightly different version. They wanted to unify their people under Roman ideals and thinking and thought and respect and worshiping. Emperor worship is rooted in this. So they valued stability so much. This also ties in with what we just covered about the zealots wanting to make Jesus a king. The one thing the Romans would not tolerate is sedition or somebody trying to upset that peace because the whole empire could fall apart being composed of so many different tribes and people and cultures. So they really valued that stability. And of course, religion, the religions, as I put it, the Romans never met a god they didn't like. So out of the Greeks, from the Greeks, they borrowed 100 or more gods and goddesses and gave them Roman names. there. They borrowed Babylonian gods and practices and Egyptian gods and goddesses and Greek gods and goddesses and practices and all of that. And that is also where a lot of the pagan concepts got into Christianity, because this is the milieu of this area of Roman thought and thinking. Different Roman emperors worshiped different gods. Some were particularly enamored with the Egyptian gods, and they dressed themselves in Egyptian dress. So religion was a touchy matter. So as the Romans expanded their empire and conquered different peoples, they allowed the people to continue worshiping their own gods so long as it did not lead to division and unsettling in the Roman Empire. So they were actually quite tolerant toward the Jews, because that was an existing religion. They had a Latin phrase for it called licit, L-I-C-I-T, licit religio, a licit or a legal religion. And Judaism was one of those. It would be like a grandfather clause. You get grandfathered in if the religion already exists. However, you could not start a new religion, because that would upset the balance. That would upset the order of things. So Judaism was a legal religion in the Roman Empire. They allowed the Jews to practice it. At times, that led to conflict, because to the Jews, there's only one God, and you can only worship and honor him. The Romans, starting with Julius Caesar, started emperor worship. And that became a source of conflict, because the Jews could not worship the emperor. We see that becoming a major area of conflict in the early church. Not so much from Bible times, but immediately after that. We know that happened. That's where a lot of the persecution came in on Christians. Your question about Judaism and Christianity is very important, because it shows the Romans initially, in the early years of the church, did not distinguish between Christianity and Judaism. They saw them as the same thing. They're going to the synagogue together. They're keeping the Sabbath together. They're keeping the holy days together. They're following the same dietary laws. So that alone shows that the early church was just, in practice, in everyday life, was a continuation of Judaism. There wasn't a conflict there. So that alone puts the lie to the fact that Christians switched to worshiping on Sunday and doing away with the food laws and this kind of thing. The Romans saw no difference between Christians and Jews there. So it is later, as emperor worship becomes more and more entrenched, as the emperors get more vain and egotistical and start requiring sacrifice to the emperor. And the way it worked is, it wasn't that you sacrificed an animal or something. What you were legally required to do is to sacrifice a little bit of incense on an altar to the emperor once a year. Everybody in the Roman Empire was required to do that. And you were actually given a little piece of paper notarized by the Romans that you had done that. You had done your act of homage to the emperor. And Christians compromised and did that, and some didn't. And depending on how strictly the local authorities wanted to enforce that or ignore it, sometimes they enforced it to keep the peace, sometimes they ignored it to keep the peace, lest it cause riots or something among the Jewish population. So that's kind of what is going on. We don't see a lot of that in the Bible, but it was building toward the end, after Peter and Paul. Well, it's under Nero's reign that Christians really start getting persecuted. Nero blames them for burning Rome. 50s, 60s AD, the persecution is starting to build, and Christianity is starting to be viewed as a threat to peace and stability. So persecution sets in. John the Apostle is imprisoned under the reign of Domitian, an exile to Patmos, and Christianity goes underground around this period because of the persecution. They're killing Christians whenever they can find them. It gets really, really ugly, and Christianity essentially disappears off the map toward the end of the first century, early part of the second century. very complex subject, but that's a quick, great question and a quick overview of what's